You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Good day, John McWhorter. How are you doing?
Good day, Glenn Lowry.
I am indeed Glenn Lowry of The Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv and also Brown University, and happy to be talking here with my friend and conversation partner at Blogging Heads, John McWhorter of Columbia University. We, John and Glenn, the black guys at bloggingheads.tv, are going to take on, in this political season, the ongoing debates about to whom should black people be giving their political support in this election season, with the Democrats' South Carolina primary coming up momentarily, John. I think it's tomorrow, isn't it? Or is it Tuesday?
Tuesday
of next week. We're speaking here on a Friday afternoon. And there are pieces being written in magazines that are declaring Hillary Clinton an unfit presidential candidate for the black vote. And other people are writing other kind of pieces. Politicians are coming out, like the Congressional Black Caucus, and endorsing Hillary Rodham Clinton for president of the United States. And then others, intellectuals and others, are writing magazine pieces declaring that she was responsible for the war on crime that her husband prosecuted and other things like this. And I just thought that would be a fit subject for us to discuss, John. You're shaking your head.
Yeah, I really, this idea that Hillary Clinton should be considered suspect and anti-black because of this legislation from 20 years ago is really an ahistorical position, because black people, and I mean black people on the left, liberal black people, community activists, were solidly behind that very legislation, that very idea that there needed to be a crackdown on crime. Now, it was overdone. It had results that nobody was expecting and that people responsible should regret. But the idea that that was only about the Clintons or only about evil white people simply doesn't work. And it's interesting because this isn't a new point. And it seems to me that a lot of people almost seek to vilify these powerful white people for it and find the actual evidence of what happened during that time. And it wasn't 1650. Uncomfortable. I remember I was giving a race talk at Harvard, and Charles Oglesby was the one who had invited me. And I made the point that I have often made, which is that the disparity in powdered versus crack cocaine was something that the Congressional Black Caucus of the time had been behind. And what I found interesting was that Oglesby was thrown by that. I'm not saying he didn't know it, but he clearly wasn't used to anybody mentioning it. And he said, well, we have to understand that nobody then knew what the results would be. And I thought, yes, that's true. Who would have known? And it's unfortunate. And you've written a lot about what the results are and that we really do need to fix it. But the idea that we should not vote for white Hillary because of the anti-black legislation, which if you went back in time, so many of what are considered good black people would have agreed with, is just basically playing cops and robbers. And I'm surprised at Michelle Alexander, because she's very smart and I really like her, and I like her book, The New Jim Crow. But really, I think she's wrong on this one. And even she has to flail a little bit in her piece that got around when she addresses the point that so many black people were behind it. She gives a very weak answer only in that part of the article. What do you think about this idea that the Clintons are to be thought of as not black people's friends because of what happened then? And you were more there than I was.
I was definitely on the scene. Let me just clarify a couple of things. For people who do not know, Charles Oglesby is the law professor at Harvard, the litigator. He was a part of the legal advising team to Anita Hill, going all the way back to the Clarence Thomas hearings, and has been a big advocate for reparations, and is a friend and former teacher of the president of the United States, has very close relationships with Barack Obama, professor at Harvard Law. African-American, and no, of course, it couldn't be that he wouldn't have known about this history of African-American grassroots agitation for stricter enforcement of anti-drug laws, including the Rockefeller laws in New York State, and including the emphasis on anti-crack cocaine trafficking because of the violence that attended the crack trade, which was wreaking havoc in these inner-city neighborhoods. And you had African-American ministers burying these teenage kids who were being gunned down in this violence that attended the crack trade regularly, and comforting their grieving widows and mothers and such. And the black politicians felt like they had to do something about it. And they were a part of this chorus of voices calling for coming down very hard on violent criminals engaged in the drug trade in the inner city neighborhoods. This is all true. This is all has been documented. There's this recent book. What's the guy's name? Fortner?
Michael Fortner, yeah.
Who's done a history of
Most
the sort of
black book of 2015, yeah.
Indeed. The guy Foreman, James Foreman Jr., the law professor at Yale, has been writing about this.
He's very good on this.
The
yeah.
legitimacy of the anti-crime sentiment being expressed by the people who were being most victimized by crime, African-American people in the relatively lawless districts of the country cities in the years from the early mid-1980s through the early 1990s, when the murder rate was through the roof and there was just a lot of carnage. So it is ahistorical. I think that. I think this Michelle Alexander, I should also explain, in The Nation magazine, had a piece with a screaming headline, Hillary Clinton doesn't deserve the vote of black people, not perhaps a quote, but that's a paraphrase of that title. And she takes Clinton to task, takes her to task for, by implication, being involved in her husband's anti-crime policies, and takes her to task for the welfare reform legislation, which passed in 1996, if I'm not mistaken, personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which constituted
EWRA.
A huge transformation of the structure of assistance to indigent families with children in the United States, abrogated the entitlement that the Social Security Act of 1935 had established to poor mothers to be able to get financial assistance from the government, brought in work conditions and time limits on welfare recipients so that you had to at least make an effort to get a job and you could only collect for a certain period of time, and completely turned upside down the structure of welfare in the country, always opposed by liberals. And the irony of it is, of course, Hillary Clinton was one of those liberals who opposed this act. She would have had to have been on the other side of the debate within the Clinton administration about this legislation.
But allowed herself to be knuckled under is the idea.
Or simply accepted the fact that she wasn't president of the United States and it wasn't
but
her
Clinton
call to make.
Would have allowed himself as the
and,
idea.
And so then we have this thing about we don't like Bill Clinton. We don't like the success of the Democrats during the 1990s. We managed to get a Democrat elected president in 1992 after three Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush administrations. And with two more Bush administrations to come after, we managed to get a Democrat elected president. He does cut some corners, split some differences, and do some things which, of course, we're going to object to, like going back to preside over the execution of Ricky Ray Rector in Arkansas in the heat of the 1992 primary campaign, leaving the campaign trail, going back to his home state. His lieutenant governor could have done it. He went back to do it as a way of signaling that he was tough on crime and that he was prepared to get behind the death penalty, whatever his personal views about it might have been. I mean, Bill Clinton did some things that you can object to, of course, in retrospect. But that crime bill had a lot of black support. That welfare bill had a lot of opposition within the Clinton administration. Hillary Clinton was a close colleague of Marion Wright Edelman, served on the board of the Children's Defense Fund, was an avid advocate on behalf of the well-being of disadvantaged children, and had this close alliance with Marion Wright Edelman. Marion Wright Edelman's husband, Peter Edelman, served in the Clinton administration in the area of social welfare policy and resigned in protest.
He wrote an article in The Atlantic about it.
A famous article, The Worst Thing Bill Clinton Ever Did, as I recall the title of that article, in which he denounced the administration's compromise with the Republicans. Mind you, now in 1994, the Republicans took control of Congress. Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House of Representatives. Bill Clinton actually wanted to get some legislation through the House of Representatives. Can you believe that? He actually wanted to be President of the United States. He wanted to govern in a country that was riven ideologically. So he split the difference. He triangulated and he made compromises. Now, the purest among us, in retrospect, with the benefit of hindsight, never having to stand for an office, can say he was a moral moron. He was a backward, whatever, whatever. If they can't tell the difference between Bill Clinton and the Gingrich Republicans, they've got to be politically blind. Anyway, I ramble. I'm very upset at this, I think, cheapening of the voice of African Americans in a serious political discourse, this playing of a kind of race card by attempting to discredit Hillary Clinton, who warts and all, is, I think, the most serious opportunity for the Democrats to retain control of the White House that we've got in front of us, to cheapen and discredit her by accusing her of racism. She uttered the phrase super predator in a speech. She used the phrase. At the time, 20-odd years ago, that phrase was everywhere in the newspapers and the magazines. I agree. Liberals objected to it. I agree. But the concern about a cohort of young crime-committing violent men in the inner cities who were changing the quality of life there and
who were reviled by the people who lived in those communities.
Indeed, indeed. And creating a deep trouble for the lives of those people. The idea that a person would be aware of I don't want to make an excuse for this because I'm on record as rejecting all of that kind of super predator rhetoric and whatnot. But again, it's a kind of anachronism for us to sit in 2016 looking backwards a quarter century and condemn somebody whose life record is a progressive record on race and social justice for being, in effect, a racist unworthy of support by black people. The mind boggles at the kind of moral high-handedness, I'm going to call it, of people who play fast and loose with history in this way. I mean, if you want to make an argument for Bernie Sanders, make the argument.
There's a little more to it too when you bring up welfare reform, because somebody like Michelle Alexander in her article becomes a numbers wonk in a way that I find a little bit too convenient. And so she says that yes, black child poverty went down significantly for a while after 1996 when welfare reform set in, but then when the economy went bust in the late aughts, black child poverty has gone back to where it was. Yes. Peter Edelman, in his Atlantic article, I remember, I think he used the expression shivering on subway grates, which got around a lot back then. The idea being that black women who were off of welfare, I don't know if black was said, but that's what everybody was thinking, were going to wind up just unable to support themselves at all. And talk about what we can know now and not in hindsight. In foresight, I can see how in 1994
person might have thought that.
Concerned person might have feared that.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen. And more to the point, to look at welfare reform and just look at the brute numbers of the poverty line and black children and start counting is irresponsible, given that I am aware of no black women interviewed, no study, and I haven't looked at anything like the totality of them, but I'm not aware of any black women who have said that the new welfare, which has a time limit and focuses more on work training, is a bad thing. And there are countless studies where the women in question say that life was a little tougher, but that they're glad that the rules were changed. There's a beautiful book called American, Oh Lord, it's been so long and I'm underslept, by Peter, this is a bad Blogging Heads moment, Peter Blank, who used to write for the New York Times.
Yeah.
The book called American Something. It tracks the lives of three ex-recipients.
I know the book you're talking about.
Yeah, and so basically, I think it's really unfair and unempirical to imply, as many people are, that if somebody supported welfare reform in the mid-90s, they were supporting something that was punitive and anti-black, and that's conclusively been shown to be the case. That wasn't a mistake at all. That policy didn't create any magic. But I consider that to be a hallmark in recent American black history, because it did an awful lot of good things, remembering that it's not that welfare was taken away. It's just that the program was changed in terms of how it was administered. And yet, you know, let's face it, most people will read someone like Michelle Alexander. I don't mean to be ad hominem against her, and just think, yeah, welfare reform 20 years ago, that was that anti-black thing that the Clintons pulled to keep in the right's good graces and to not look too left.
Okay, I got to push back. I have to push back because I'm an academic, and so are you. But I actually live amongst sociologists, social psychologists, and left-wing, policy analyst type people who will string me up. They'll have what Clarence Thomas called a high-tech lynching on me if I don't push back here.
I'm interested.
Because it is absolute gospel. In this quarter, go to any school of social work anywhere in America, okay? Mm-hmm. Go to any sociology department and speak to the people who are experts on family welfare policy and things like that. And you're going to find the view pretty much 100% that welfare reform was mean-spirited. The welfare reform of 1996, it was motivated by anti-black animus. It was built on the back of a whole bunch of canards about unwed
Welfare
mothers
cheap.
having six babies by six different men, about
Right.
women living off of, about welfare cheats. I mean, they'll go all the way back to Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign and tell you about how this all culminates, and they'll pull out the horror shows. And I can even remember this, a guy standing on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1995 or so, a Republican congressman from Florida, holding up a sign saying, "Please don't feed the alligators." And what he was saying was that in the Everglades, they have a sign. It says, "Please don't feed the alligators." Now, why do we have the sign? Because if you feed the alligators, they will forget how to find the food for themselves. It's not a good idea to feed the alligators. They'll become dependent on getting a handout from the tourist rather than being able to fend in the Everglades ecology to find their own food. And he was likening that to the ill effects on the women who might be receiving welfare benefits for becoming dependent upon a check coming from the government instead of learning how to take care of themselves. People will say that the discourse about welfare was so heavily racialized that whatever the policy argument on its behalf, the political fact of that act becoming law was a victory for forces of anti-black racism and anti-black sentiment. It was mean-spirited in the sense that it shifts the burden off of the government to take care of indigent children, onto their parents who are now required to go to work, go to school, so on. Now, I'm not arguing with you, John, about whether that was good or bad policy. You think it's good? I just want to make the case that other people might have thought that it was bad. But I agree with you that in retrospect, it wasn't that bad. Okay? In retrospect, people were not sleeping on grades. In retrospect, children were not starving to death. Indeed, with a strong economy, the poverty rate among African Americans declined. Of course, the numbers of people on the welfare rolls declined dramatically as a consequence of the reform because it became stricter, it limited the amount of time people could stay on, and it became much less attractive for people to be on. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? We have to go find those kids, find out whether or not they're in school, whether their health is okay, whether they're getting a certain number of calories every day, and so forth and so on. I am not aware of an empirical case demonstrating that the quality of life because of welfare reform as a whole amongst poor African Americans was made worse. So I want to do two things here. Agree with you that in hindsight, it wasn't all that bad as people thought, like Peter Edelman, it was going to be, but emphasize that at the time that it was happening and in political memory, the forces, the ideological forces that were aligned on behalf of and against that bill did have built into them a history of anti-black sentiment and so forth. And I could see a person saying Bill Clinton got himself on the wrong side of history by cutting a deal with Newt Gingrich and company over that legislation. So anyway, I hope I can still come to the cocktail party. I'm talking to my colleagues out there now. I don't want to get shut out of the cocktail
All of that is completely
party.
true. I've heard all of it myself. Yes, there was some anti-black sentiment that was part of the wind behind that legislation. But you know what, Glenn? As far as I'm concerned, it's the result that interests me. And a lot of the people who are so offended by that racialized rhetoric, and I guess it differs where one puts it, are not thinking about the history of welfare over 50 years as opposed to 25, and how the welfare as we know it, as Clinton put it, was something that had only originated starting in the late 60s, and that before that there was a very different kind of welfare, and that in some ways, Black America and the family were better news than they were afterward. And my idea was never that there should be no welfare. I think the idea of 5 years with job training more strictly incorporated within it is a mark of a humane society. 5 years. The way it's talked about is as if the idea was that you could get on welfare for 5 months. 5 years. Yes, certainly. But just not open-ended, not where in most states nobody cares whether you get a job. The idea that somehow that was a humane social program. Now, okay, there are some people who are thinking we've got to get these welfare queens off of the streets. I'm well aware there was never such thing as a welfare queen. Nobody got rich on welfare. But if the idea was to create what welfare TANF, as it's been, has been like since 1996, then pitfalls acknowledged. I always thought this is a step in the right direction. And I think that people who can't get past the fact that some of the people who supported it were unsavory are looking for a world that is less, that is more perfect than I'm aware of.
You know? I think that's right. And I think evidence on behalf of your position, which says that in retrospect, it wasn't such a bad thing, notwithstanding the ideological terrain, is that there's no movement to change it.
Nope.
We've had, since 2008, a lot of discussion, Occupy Wall Street, income inequality, wealth inequality, but Bernard Sanders is running on that. Nobody's talking about reconfiguring the welfare regime in the interest of greater equality. If it were indeed a failed policy regime, it would be a low-hanging fruit for mm-hmm. the anti-inequality persons to be going after. Bernard Sanders. Sanders Anderson, there's a lot of overlap in those names.
There is.
Bernard Sanders would have a program for free college education, and he'd have a program for breaking up the banks, and he'd have a program for reducing the amount of incarceration, which we should talk about, and right. he'd have a program for redoing welfare. But guess what? He doesn't have a program for redoing welfare. I guess we have to conclude from that the current system, warts and all, is probably not as bad as people thought it was going to be. So agreed about that. But what about incarceration? The crime bill, omnibus crime bill that Bill Clinton signed, more death penalties at the federal level, 100,000 cops on the street. Is that a good or a bad thing for black people? I really want Michelle Alexander, again, with respect, it's not ad hominem, and Cornel West, again, with respect, to tell me whether or not 100,000 cops on the streets of American cities is bad for black people. I want them to point out how the fall in the crime rate... The fall in the crime rate from the early 1990s until now, which is precipitate, it falls dramatically. I mean, you've got like half the crime. Homicide rates are down by 2/3 in these cities and so forth. Most of the victims were black. Burglary rates are down. Property theft is so forth. Tell me, is that bad for black people? Is 100,000 cops in too bad? Okay, so we can debate that. And he gave, in this bill, federal money to the states, encouraging them to build more prison capacity.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton has himself said that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. We overshot with respect, and I've written a book about this. I mean, I'm on the record as with Michelle Alexander objecting to the elaboration of a system of mass incarceration. But laying that with the benefit of hindsight as a moral indictment at the feet of, quote, the Clintons, they gave us mass incarceration, is a distortion, and it's a selective report. About the history. And I think it's deeply unfair. I really do. I mean, as I said earlier in this conversation, Bill Clinton was trying to govern a fractious country and deal with a horrific set of policy problems. He made some mistakes. In hindsight, we can see them. Over-incarceration was one of them. But to say that they're racist, unfit to occupy high office or to have the support of African Americans because they did this seems very, very unfair to me.
You know, there's another point that has been made, and this is Michelle Alexander's, in itself, magnificent article in terms of writing, in terms of rhetoric. This is, I don't want anybody to perceive that we are addressing her in the way that we've addressed a certain someone else. But I really do think that her piece is misleading in certain ways. It's clear. I suspect that an editor said, don't you want to address the fact that black people were behind this legislation? And so she has a healthy paragraph or two where she says, yes, many black people were behind it, but these people were also asking for better health care for black people, better schools for black people, mental health care, and she mentions a couple of other things. And her implication is that the Clintons had no interest in that. They just wanted to throw people into jail. So the implication is that these black community leaders were making some 6-point plan as their request, and the Clintons instead just threw a bunch of people into jail, paying attention to only one thing that these community leaders asked for. I don't go for it. I mean, I wasn't paying as much attention then as I am now, but I was reading political magazines and keeping a close watch. This is around when I became politicized. And first of all, I'm not aware that these community leaders weren't making a particularly strong pitch to get the quote-unquote predators off the street. It wasn't that they were saying that and then making these 5 other points. It was a big central issue. And second, I'm not aware that the Clintons had no concern whatsoever with education. It would seem that they had quite a concern with health care, I mean, given what Hillary Clinton was known for at the time. The Clintons had a social act as if they were both president. Bill Clinton's administration had a strong, socially active commitment. There are all sorts of press meetings and subcommittees and projects that I'm sure we could find in the history of that administration, especially the first 4 years of it, where Bill Clinton was concerned to at least a decent degree with issues of concern to people of color. And instead, people are implying that basically Clinton threw a bunch of people into jail and ignored an equally clamorous debate among black people about other things that we needed. I think it's a distortion. The black leaders wanted to make the streets safe. That was paramount in their view. Am I distorting that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm thinking about a couple of things. I'm thinking about Lonnie Guinier.
Oh, yeah.
Lonnie Guinier, law professor at Harvard, African-American woman.
That was about affirmative action.
Was nominated to be assistant secretary, I mean, assistant attorney general for civil rights in the Clinton administration. She's a prominent intellectual, a writer about voting rights and affirmative action issues, a progressive, I don't think a critical race studies devotee, but not unfriendly to the critical race studies legal academy, and a progressive writer on behalf of increasing the electoral power of the African-American voice in American politics through various shifts in voting policy. This is Lonnie Guinier. He nominated her. There was a fierce effort amongst the conservatives to prevent her from being confirmed as the assistant attorney general for civil rights.
Because she could have been read as supporting quotas.
Right? Exactly. She was caricatured as the quota queen, precisely.
Right, right.
We could go into the details. She had certain ideas about how not having first past the post, kind of winner take all elections, in which if blacks were 40% of the population, no black would ever get elected. You should have single member districts so that the black neighborhoods could have a 80% pop, you know, and you should, et cetera. Draw congressional district lines to include a majority districts which were majority minority to ensure that blacks would be represented. She had various other proportional voting and other schemes. We could go into the details, but the bottom line was simply having people go to the ballot box and having the majority rule did not ensure equal political right to a discrete minority. And I think that general point is accepted, even if one were to quibble about some of the policy recommendations. But at the time, she was projected as quota queen. Bill Clinton dumped her. He withdrew her nomination. He abandoned. He didn't fight for her. He didn't fight the conservatives on this. He didn't fall on his sword by picking a fight about quotas that he felt he wasn't going to win and that was going to keep him from being effective in other venues.
And Lonnie Guinier has written that when it was all over, that she encountered the Clintons walking down the hall in the other direction, and Hillary walked by her and said, "Sorry, kiddo," which I must admit is a magnificently condescending and dismissive line. I can imagine how that must have felt. "Sorry, kiddo," and that was it.
I never heard that story, but yeah.
That's what happened to Lonnie Guinier.
Right. sorry about that old nomination thing. You know, stuff happens up here in Washington. I'm sorry.
Kiddo. Right. Kiddo. Yeah. And they were about the same age. Yeah, that I remember that story.
And there's the Sister Soldier meme. Okay. While he's running for president, Bill Clinton goes out of his way in some public event to put down a budding hip hop early black music star who had radical views about politics by basically, you know, not letting her play a race card on him, fronting her in a public meeting. And
well, she made a statement that could be taken as suggesting that it was okay to kill cops. She said something rhetorical in the way that many rappers often had started doing around that time. And Bill Clinton disavowed it, and many saw that as another one of his cynical gestures to show that he would be tough on crime, and I guess on black people.
And of course, it was.
And it made her famous, but yeah.
No, my point is, just like Barack Obama threw his pastor of 20 years, Jeremiah Wright, under the bus in the interest of, well, getting elected, so too did Bill Clinton find, who was deeply sympathetic to the basic interests of African-American political aspiration. I mean, he was running against George Herbert Walker Bush, and in 96 he ran against against Bob Dole. Think about what those administrations would have meant. But you know, he had to play the game that he was playing, and I don't hold it against him As uncomfortable as it is to see him make that move, I, at the end of the day, have to credit him as being a shrewd political operator who understands the environment he's working in and takes the actions that he needs to take. And like I say, he wouldn't be the only one. We got Barack Hussein Obama, who's had to do some very similar things. So, I mean, I think we should move on to some other subject here, because the sum of it is, I think we both agree that you can vote for Hillary Clinton if you're black, you can vote for Bernard Sanders if you're black, whatever. But that the idea that the Clintons were racist in the early mid-90s, and that's a reason for black people to abandon them, just doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
I like the Democratic National Committee. I'll openly admit that I cheered that whole new ideology back when I was coming out of my
You
20s.
mean the Democratic Leadership Council, I assert.
Leadership Council, yes. That struck me as a good new direction. I'm not saying it was perfect, but I thought it will win elections. It's pragmatic. They have their hearts in the right places. That to me worked. And this postmortem that's being done on all of that now depresses me because I think that a lot of good things came out of the DLC.
Okay,
I don't know how
so,
you were feeling at that time, but that's how I felt.
oh no, I was kind of a Republican or a kind of recovering Republican. Remember, I voted for Ronald Reagan when he was running for president. I would have gone to work for the Reagan administration if I hadn't had to withdraw my nomination because of personal scandal. And so I didn't vote for Bill Clinton in 1992. God, are my children ever going to speak to me again? I voted for President Bush in 1992 when I was a young conservative, but I was just beginning to come out of that. The DLC, I would have never given the Democrats a second look if it hadn't have been for the DLC. People don't remember. The party, the Democratic Party, had moved way to the left and kind of was off the hook on certain issues and was doomed to minority status forever. And the philosophy of the DLC, which was different splinting at splinted difference splitting and centrist, was also a good read of the practical political landscape, and Bill Clinton, along with others, were able to leverage that insight into getting elected to the presidency of the United States. It was a historic shift in the American, this is post-Reagan. This is changing the narrative post-Reagan. I don't know how else it was going to get done. I mean, people have to live in the real world, I want to say, about things like that. Hindsight is 2020. We can all become moralist in hindsight, but if you don't live to fight another day, it all becomes irrelevant. Think of what a Republican presidency and a Republican Congress would have done in the 1990s. Okay, NAFTA. That's another thing that people are holding against the Clinton, the trade agreements. We could go into that. Neoliberalism, you know, the relaxation of the Glass-Steagall banking regulations and the liberalization of trading on Wall Street, which people say, I think in an overly simplified way, but there is some merit to it, brought us the financial crisis of 2007, 2008. But still, so there's enough to chew on in going back and looking at these things. But the characterization of Hillary Rodham Clinton, whose husband was president, as being an unacceptably conservative Democrat based on that experience is just, it's a bridge too far for me. I don't get it. I don't see it.
There were intelligent arguments for and against NAFTA. Hindsight is 2020 when it comes to Glass-Steagall and all of the outcomes thereof.
Although people at the time were objecting, people at the time were predicting, so, you
And
know.
I will never forget. In the early 90s, I remember what I was doing. I was enthralled to this new DLC. I was reading what I guess we're supposed to consider the evil New Republic, who were cheerleaders for exactly that, and I would be
Yep.
drinking my red wine. That was my awakening
And
to these.
I was writing for this evil new republic, you know.
That's right, I was reading you in it. And I refused to disavow that time as a time when I was falling for right-wing rhetoric couched in soft language. That is not what was going on then. What was going on then was politics and pragmatism. I'm almost liking that time better than now. In many ways. You know, Glenn, before I run home, tell me, Sanders or Clinton?
Yes,
Who are
me.
you gonna,
Me
who are
personally?
you? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm supporting Clinton.
Why not him?
I'm supporting Clinton because I want to see a Democrat in the White House in 2017. And because I'm not a socialist and I think a lot of the policy stuff is pie in the sky. This is obviously more to cover than we're going to be able to talk about with any kind of detail in this one conversation, which is already halfway along. But I'm for Clinton over Sanders for a number of reasons. First of all, I think she's more qualified to be president of the United States than anybody in either party who's running right now. I think she's got more than a quarter of a century of experience at the top of government. I think she's an easy target. What did Carly Fiorina say? Mrs. Clinton, air travel is not an accomplishment, it's an activity. The woman was Secretary of State of the United States of America. Okay, Benghazi, she screwed up. The Russian reset didn't work out the way we planned. Yes, you can criticize her tenure as Secretary of State. My reading of it, I'm no, you know, foreign policy guru, is she did a competent or more than competent job in representing this country as Secretary of State. Was she perfect? No. Was she an absolute disaster? Not in my opinion. She did a pretty good job, and she reported to somebody who is the where the buck stops. His name is Barack Hussein Obama, and he's the president of the United States. You want to blame the screw-up with the Russians ending up in Syria and the Middle East? You blame Barack Hussein Obama. You want to blame taking out Gaddafi? You blame Barack Hussein Obama at the end of the day. Okay, and you blame Hillary Clinton, too. But still, I give her decent passing grades as Secretary of State. She was a senator from New York. She represented the state of New York. She got herself elected to the United States Senate. She was the chief advisor and consular for 8 years to the most powerful person on the planet. That would have been her husband, Bill Clinton. She is super smart. She's seasoned. She's tough. Okay? She's qualified to be president, vastly more qualified and prepared for the office than was Barack Hussein Obama when he assumed the office in 2009. So she's the best candidate. She is a woman, and that matters to me. In my humble opinion, the revolutionary implication of having a woman as the chief operating officer, the chief political officer, the chief military officer of this country is greater than is the symbolic and revolutionary significance of having an African-American occupy that office. I know that can be argued. I just stated my opinion. She's earned it. She has paid her dues, okay? And on the other side, I say of Bernie Sanders, who's a good and decent man and has a vision. He has a dream. Imagine. You know, you remember that John Lennon song, you know, imagine that there was no war. Imagine that there was no poverty. You know, people say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. Can't we envision a better world? That's what he's trying to do. I'm not against that. I'm for prophecy. I just don't know, see it winning in the ballot box, okay? And I'm against socialism, okay? Now, I know people are going to get mad at me for that, too. I'm an economist, for crying out loud. We study the way markets work, how the price system is the best way of allocating resources and so forth and so on. Central planning is dead. People are going to say I'm throwing around labels and canards and whatnot. No, I'm not. There is no free lunch. You declare free stuff. It's not free. Somebody pays. It's just that the price is hidden from the person who's consuming the service. $15 an hour minimum wage. It's a bad idea, in my opinion. Okay, there, I said it again. Now, you want to get mad at me out there in blocking his line? You can get mad at me. $15 an hour minimum wage prices my people, unskilled, urban, African-Americans who didn't finish high school and can barely write the English language, out of the labor market. It cuts the bottom rungs of the ladder off for those people. I don't think it's a very good idea. You want to help them? Give them some money. Increase the earned income tax credit. But don't make their labor so expensive that nobody wants to take a chance on having them clean up the stock room and sweep up and put the stuff on the shelf. They need to get a toehold into the economy. Employment is the absolutely most important first step to stabilizing a young person's life. Easy to say if you're the second or third breadwinner in a household who's going out to a job and your hours are going to get cut back by 10%. But if you're a kid who's not going to get a second look because $15 an hour plus your health care means that it's not worth it to give you a second look, you just had your opportunities cut out. So the banks, yes. There does need to be stricter regulation. Breaking them up, turning over the finance, I've said this here on Blogging Heads before in a conversation with Harold Pollack, turning over the goose that's laying the golden eggs of a global financial industry concentrated in New York City, generating huge amounts of economic activity for Americans and placing us at the center of international economic affairs. Turning that industry over to the socialist regulator, Bernard Sanders, is a nightmare in my mind. I don't think it's good for America. That's not protecting these guys' profits. You want to take their wealth? Pass a law and take their wealth. But don't break up all the banks and put taxes on all the transactions and muck around with, like I say, a goose that I think is to a certain degree for the American economy, laying a golden egg. Now, it's true. I'm a professional economist. I'm a neoliberal. I know Lawrence Summers. Lawrence Summers is a friend of mine. I don't agree with everything he says, but he's a very, very smart economist. So I'm not moved by the socialist catechism. So there's a positive. I think Hillary Clinton's the best person for the job, and there's a negative. I don't think Bernard Sanders can win, and I wouldn't want him to win at some level. I mean, if he's running against Donald Trump, I'll vote for Bernard Sanders, but I wouldn't want his policies to actually be implemented because I think they may do more damage than good, actually.
Well, Glenn, with that, I think we have to close, but I want to say that we should talk more about this issue. I am for Clinton as well. I should tell the Blogging Heads audience that on Tuesday I am arguing that free speech is threatened on campus with Wendy Kaminer in the Intelligence Squared series. We are going to Yale to make that argument, and apparently one can listen to it or watch it as it is happening. And so, Glenn, I'll have to report to you how that goes.
Well, I just want to, yeah, I know we have to go, John. I want to reiterate for the audience, you guys ought to find out when this debate at Yale is going to take place, and you ought to log on, okay? Because it's going to be a live, wild ride. And I expect that John is going to be the virtuoso expositor of his points of view, which he has always been here at bloggingheads.tv. So that's a knowable thing, what the URL is for that. And it's going to be on the Eastern Seaboard on Tuesday, March 1st. At what time of
You
day,
know
John?
more about this than I do. The taping is in between 6 and 8:15, but I doubt if those are the times we need to give out here. We can
Okay.
put it up. We can put it up on the site. I'm not
Okay.
sure exactly when it
Stay
begins.
tuned, blogging heads. John is on the move. Yale University. I hope they allow you to finish your sentences up there, John.
I will never be invited to that campus again, but this will be my last time. So we'll see.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.